And welcome, Scott Hunter, to the very first Misfit Geek podcast.
Thanks, Joe. Great to be here, especially for your very first podcast.
And Scott, you are a senior lead program manager, is that right? On the ASP.NET team, and senior lead, I think, means that sounds to me like the way that Microsoft does titles, that you started out as a senior program manager and you keep doing great things and they keep adding accolades on top of your title.
The main difference between a senior program manager and a lead program manager is a lead program manager, when you're a senior, you typically would own a feature area. For example, when I first joined the team, I owned and still own actually the data area, pretty much anything that ASP.NET does with data. And when you become a lead program manager at Microsoft, what that really means is you have people that report to you.
And so a senior lead has a bunch of both?
Yeah, so I own some feature areas, and I have people that report to me as well. So now, when I started off, I was just doing the data area, and now I own, I work on the web forms, MVC, and data.
Well, that's a great lead-in, because the first set of immediate questions that I got from customers to ask you was having to do with MVC versus web forms, and lots of concern from millions of ASP.NET developers that our apparent focus on MVC in some way means that we're declaring that web forms was a mistake and MVC is its replacement.
Right. Yeah, we see this at trade shows as well. Customers come up and ask that question, should I move all my, I've got a big website with 100 pages. Should I convert this to MVC? And, my typical answer is your website working for you? Yeah, it's working great. Then why would you want to change it? I do understand the question that, MVC has obviously got a lot of the PR on, even our website, ASP.NET, and in general among Microsoft recently. But I do want to say that, we have a full feature team working on web forms, and we have a ton of investments in web forms that are coming in .NET 4. So I think that our customers are going to see that we've actually gone and taken a lot of the pain points that we've heard about web forms over the last couple of years. And comically enough, these same pain points are the things that you would typically hear the MVC crowd saying that, I want to use MVC because it doesn't have this problem or this problem. One of the things we've done in .NET 4 is gone through and really addressed, a lot of those. And I can point out a few of the big heavy hitter items. Common complaints that we hear on web forms have been client IDs. A client ID is anytime you put a web control on a page, ASP.NET, under the covers, automatically creates an ID for the control. And it does this to guarantee that there would never be two controls on the page that have the same ID. And part of the negative of this is the way things work is each time a control is nested inside of what we call a naming container, and these could be master pages, it could be panels, it could be a grid, some automatic goop gets added to the front of the control ID. So the next thing you know, you have you put a control on your page and you set the ID on your control to text box 1, and when it's actually admitted on the page, you end up seeing CTL 002 under 003 under text box 1, and you're like, gosh, why did it do that? I have no control over that. So that is one of the areas that we are investing in 4.0, and we're giving you control of that back.
So in the earlier days of ASP.NET, it would seem to me that the reason for doing that sort of thing is that there were tons and tons of enterprise developers who were coming to web development from things like Visual Basic, Power Builder, Delphi, that sort of thing, and they didn't really understand the sort of plumbing of web applications development. I mean, is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's accurate, and I think it's accurate that, number one, when ASP.NET was first created, we were, and the world was more in a in a desktop development era, and we were trying to make the transition from desktop to web very easily, hence the term web form. If you were a long time, you know, if you've experienced Visual Basic before, Visual Basic, when you coded in Visual Basic, they were called forms. And you know, the terminology we use in ASP.NET is web form. So we took the form concept from Visual Basic, applied it to the web, and tried to make, you know, a lot of that functionality very similar with drag and drop. And obviously in the drag and drop cases and stuff like that, you're not aware that there's IDs and the web is actually emitting these IDs to the pages and they can't, you know, they have to be unique and stuff like that. So yeah, we tried to hide some of that, complexity. And then I think the biggest area where if people can think and understand this is when you start looking at data controls. So if I look at a data control today and I define a row, on the definition of my row, I say, text box, first name, text box, last name, text box, social security number. Those are my IDs for my three controls.
Right.
Well, obviously, as we loop and show that, you know, let's say we show 10 items, well, we can't name all 10 items, the same. And so really where you start seeing this auto generation of client IDs is in the data controls because they're typically repeating over information multiple times, and so we have to do something to make each of those IDs slightly unique for each row.
Well, and the AJAX phenomenon has changed the expectation of client-side behavior, I think, and so it's great that ASP.NET is evolving to facilitate the developer. And relative to client IDs, that gives me a couple of questions. First is, so client IDs will allow the developer to specify what they want the client representation of a particular server-side control to be. And will this also resolve the issues with how names change inside containers and particularly some of the AJAX control toolkit controls? Like, for example, there's some naming issues when you use controls inside the accordion control.
Yeah, I haven't tried using the new 4.0 behave, 4 behave, I shouldn't. Actually, you can test the 4.0 because we don't actually call things 4.0. I have not actually played with the new options we added in .NET 4 with the accordion control, but I can explain a little bit of what the options are. We basically have a new property on any of our controls called client ID mode. It will default to a value that basically is equivalent to what we get today, but we give the developer a couple of new choices. One of those new choices is you can set it to static. And if you set it to static, then basically what we're saying is no matter what the naming container is, whatever you name that control, it will say that name. Now there's a caveat with that is because we've given you full control when you set this to static, there's nothing in the ASP.NET page that will guarantee that this control is unique anymore.
Right. So you're free to make your mistakes and shoot yourself in your foot.
Exactly. So you're free to make mistakes, shoot yourself in the foot. The second one, and I think the nicest one that we have another mode called predictable. And what it does is instead of doing the CTL XXX, which normally we would put a prefix of CTL, which stands for control, and a three-digit of numbers, CTL 000, 001, instead of that, we will actually make a very nice looking client ID. So for example, a great example of this is what I could do is in a grid view, I could actually say I want to use predictable, and there's another new property called row client ID suffix, and I can take the row client ID suffix and set it to say the primary key for my data, and then basically it would be text box under primary key, which would be very pretty typically. And it's also predictable from the standpoint, you know, I know, based on the data, what the actual IDs are going to look like.
So let me ask you for just relative to future discussions, have you considered the possibility of creating control arrays of given types, a la VB6 and before, where I can create put six text boxes on a page, or I should say on a form, and give them all the same name, and they're automatically combined into an array that can be iterated over.
We have not talked about that, no.
Oh, cool. I'll send in my feature request.
Yeah, actually, I've not heard that request from anybody. So I'd be curious to ask you, have you actually heard a request for that? I know you go around and meet a lot of customers and go to a lot of trade shows and stuff. Have you actually heard feedback from customers that they want something like that?
Yeah, I had lots of requests for that sort of feature in the earlier days of ASP.NET. I think one of the things that happens to things like that is that, you know, they talk about it in the beginning and then they just sort of assume that it's not there, so it's not going to happen, and they start to get used to doing things in an alternative way. But one of my particular pains in web format programming has had to do with the dynamic addition of control instances on the page. So the ability to add a control to an array and then have state and postback reconstitution automatically sort of just happen would be a great feature addition.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking at my whiteboard because we actually have, there's something on my whiteboard that we wrote up. If I can see what the name of it was. It was, I see it now. It's called, this is an idea. We're not doing this in .NET 4, but it is something we've talked about. It's basically a common request that I have seen requests for this, and it's very similar to along the lines that what you're talking about is a lot of our customers in the page load event will actually dynamically create a control. And then what will happen is as soon as a postback occurs on that page, their dynamically created control doesn't exist anymore.
Right, so you need to save local reference to it. Then in the pre-init event, you have to manually reconstitute them. And it's doable, but it's not the same convenient programming model.
Correct. I mean, what people don't realize is that people, especially in the early days when they were coming from things like Visual Basic, you know, in Visual Basic, when you add something to a form, that form is always going to exist. And people don't realize that in an ASP.NET application, your form only exists for that one single request. So it's on that initial draw of the page, that form was created and disposed of. And then so if you press a button or something on that page that causes the page to refresh, a brand new request comes in and a brand new form is created, and whatever that dynamically created control was, it no longer exists. And so as you said, there are ways to solve this. Obviously, the correct way to do this would be in page init. You would always recreate any dynamic controls that you put on the page. And if you do it in the stage and you name them the same every single request, things like view state and stuff like that will actually hook up and work normally.
Yeah, but don't you agree that that while that works, there's a fair bit of repetitive plumbing code in there that we could put into the framework itself, or into WinForms. Into WebForms.
Yeah, I have an item on my whiteboard which is called Control Manager, and what the idea behind Control Manager is, as I said, this is just an idea that we have, and I think we did actually prototype it, but which means it might show up in CodePlex at some point, but it's not actually in .NET 4.
Right.
What Control Manager was a mechanism where you basically, if you want to dynamically create controls, you would dynamically create them via the control manager, and it would be responsible for saving some state between requests, so it knew how to recreate the control on the next postback. So what would happen is as you add a control to the control manager is responsible for keeping a tree of those controls that were added and adding them into view state or some form of state. So the next time the page is requested, we can completely rebuild that control tree.
Well, and a possible extension to that is another sometimes received request is the ability to maintain page state at instances in time across multiple page navigations.
Yes. I have seen some of those, and we've looked at that at multiple times, and there's a lot of complexity with that, and that's the reason we haven't gone down a path like that is because of those complexities. Now we do have some of the stuff that we did in .NET 3.5 SP1 allows you, you know, once again with some code on yourself to achieve some of that. So we added a feature called AJAX History in .NET 3.5 SP1, and what AJAX History does is tries to solve some of this problem for AJAX sites. So I'm sure the people that are listening to this podcast have probably seen this kind of behavior on websites before. You know, if you go and to a typical website and the page posts back to itself multiple times and then you AJAXify that page, as soon as you AJAXify a page, there's not a new page being created every time an action occurs on the page, and so the back button starts failing to work. The back button is going to say, I'm going to take you to the previous page. Well, every request I've been making on that page really hasn't been changing the page. It's actually been doing a partial rendering.
Right. So the
content of the page has been changing, but not via a navigation action.
And the back button takes you to your home page.
That's correct. Right. And so what history support that we added in .NET 3.5 SP1 allows you to do is each time one of these partial renderings occurs, you can actually set a bookmark and give that bookmark a little bit of state. And what will happen then is when the back button is pressed in the browser, the page will actually get an event telling it which bookmark it should go to and giving it that piece of state that was saved as part of the bookmark. And so the idea is if you build this up correctly, it allows you every time the backspace occurs, you're giving that some of that state back, and you should be able to recreate the previous state of the page. Which, as I said, it gives you a mechanism to solve a little bit of the problem you're talking about. But it is, I will say, you know, you are going to write a fair amount of code to do that, because you know, it's up to you to manage that state and to rebuild the page, you know, based on the state.
Right. So, hey, you just gave me a great idea. I've been thinking about the kinds of podcasts that I want to do, and it's great that we're talking not just about what's going to be in 4.0, but the kinds of things that you're thinking about for maybe someday in the future if customers tell us it's important. And that's sort of what I wanted to do with this podcast. There are some great podcasts that are ASP.NET related. Scott Hanselman and my team, you know, does one of the most popular ones, but I wanted to do something that exposes more of the folks that make the product happen inside Microsoft and sort of opens up that conduit of dialogue through me and my website with the product feature teams. And so I think a great webcast will be for me to just schedule a meeting with you and your team in your office and then do a podcast on whatever's on your whiteboard at that point in time.
Yeah, well, you know, and something else that, you know, while we're talking about this that we would love is we consider ourselves to be a very customer-driven team. We do a lot of releases on www.codeplex.com/ASP.NET. If you go to that today, you can see previews of our AJAX. You can see previews typically of MVC. It's just RTM'd recently, so there's not anything new there. You can see previews of dynamic data. You can see previews of other investments that we're investigating. And part of the reason that we post a lot of code up there before it actually makes it in the product is that's a place that we would like our customers to be able to go and look at what's up there and give us feedback on should it be in the product, should it not be in the product, X, Y, Z. At the same time, I would love to do exactly what you said, which is, get the whole team on one of these calls. It would be especially fun to actually say, you know, maybe, I'm not sure if it's after this podcast or your next podcast, to basically say, why don't you give everybody a week or two to come up with a list of questions, fire the questions to you, and on the podcast, what we can do is basically round robin with somebody from the AJAX team, somebody from the MVC team, somebody from WebForm, somebody from Data, and we can all try to answer, you know, whatever questions that your listeners have asked.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And the other thing I think I want to do is ambush podcasts where I just show up in your office for a time I reserved and say, okay, tell me about this on the spot. I don't know how much you guys would like that idea, but
no, actually, I think something that you and I know you and I talked about it probably a year ago, and we haven't had a chance to do it, and I'm not sure exactly how to do it, but it would be very interesting to find some way to have you show up and record part of a feature team meeting, because you know I think our customers probably don't appreciate. A lot of times, you know, you see the same feature request time and time again. You go, well, God, why don't they put that in the product? And the reason something doesn't make it in the product typically is, you know, as you start looking at an idea, we start looking at all the edge cases that it breaks in.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, we always hear folks say, oh, you know, how hard could that be? I could do it in a weekend. And, you know, when you think about the feature in isolation, maybe that's true, but when you have to consider, you know, the impact of, or the possible impact in any one of 10,000 namespaces in the framework, then it becomes a much more complex discussion.
Yeah, I mean, a great example of something like this that happened very recently was one of the areas that we have a lot of investment in .NET 4 is around CSS for web forms, because that's been one of the areas that we've gotten a lot of negative feedback for in the past. And what the negative feedback is there's some things that web forms does that you have no control to change. So, for example, if you put an AST table control on the page, without you even asking, you're going to get a border equals zero associated with this thing. And there isn't really a good way for you to turn that off.
Right.
And so one of the areas that we're investing in CSS is some hooks and controls in to say, let's change web forms so you don't ever get markup that you didn't ask for. And you know, that sounds pretty simple. And one of the areas that we were working on is actually in all the controls in web forms today have something called disabled. You can disable something. Well, in HTML world, it's only legal to actually put the disabled equals disabled attribute on an input control. This is a control that actually takes input. So you shouldn't do this on a span. You shouldn't do this on a div. And so one of the areas that we are actually addressing in .NET 4 is making a change where we only put disabled equals disabled on input controls. So you go, that doesn't sound like a big change, but the question is how does that affect every third-party company that's written their own control that derives from our base control?
Right, and we've just changed default state for the classes that they derive from.
Exactly. Suddenly, when somebody buys one of those control packages or downloads an open source one from the net and sets disabled equal true, or enabled equals true is what we call the value in the property on the control, it doesn't render that attribute anymore.
Right.
And who knows what we will break when we do something like that. And stuff like that, and trying to figure out how to do that. And so we actually, you know, did that in a way where it will not traditionally break a control. So what we actually added is a Boolean property to the base control where it can return whether it's an input control or not. And by default, we'll set that to return true, true, that I am an input control, which means by default, every control would be an input control. Thus, the disabled equals disabled would behave the same. And what we've then done is gone through our control and made everyone that's not an input control return false there. But that's the kind of thing that I think I would like our customers to appreciate is it's not necessarily about, as you said, making a change quickly. It's, okay, how can we make sure that when this version of the framework installs in your box, we don't break your existing website.
Right.
We don't break the control vendors that build controls that are sold on top of the framework. That's a big deal for us. I mean, the number of support calls we get when we make a change like that, which sometimes we do by accident. I mean, a great example of this is something we did in .NET 3.5 SP1. Something that we actually by accident broke was in previous versions of the framework, if you set the action on a form, any ASP.NET form that was set to run at server, we basically ignored that action. And the reason we ignored that action was because in a traditional case, the page, the way ASP.NET works, web forms works, is it does postbacks to itself. And if you set the action, you basically are setting the page that when somebody does submit the page, the values will be sent to. And so in a traditional web form case, the values always need to come back to the same page. And so if you ever set action in 1.0 or 1.1 or 2.0, it was basically ignored. No matter what you put in there, we would just eat it and always make the page have an action back to itself, because that's the way that the post-back model that WebForms uses works.
So why was there even an action property?
Well, the action property is a property that's just part of the form element in general. It's an HTML property. It's a legal value for the control. And ASP.NET has always had the notion of something we call expando attributes, which means even if we didn't have a property called action on the form, you can always type, you know, foobar equals test, and that will show up as an attribute on that element.
Right.
Because we don't claim to know what all the elements are, because they could change some stuff. So anyways, in this case, we always basically, no matter if you went and set action on the form, it was ignored. And then in 3.5.SP1, I'm sure we had some requests from somebody that said, hey, I want to actually be able to change the action on the page. So we went and allowed you to actually, if you change the action to point to a different page, when the page posts back, it will actually post back to the new page. Well, inadvertently, we broke a bunch of customers. I shouldn't say a bunch. I'm not sure how many we broke, but we broke enough that it came to product support that what they had basically done is they had actually gone and set action on some of their pages in the past, and we basically ignored it, and it did nothing. Well, suddenly after they installed 3.5.SP1, you know, when they developed these pages, they probably realized at some point that action didn't do anything, but they didn't go and take them back off. So as soon as they installed 3.5.SP1, their pages started breaking because we started honoring that attribute and shooting them over to the pages that they had put in there. And so, you know, once again, that's an example of a very small change that when we're making a change like that, we're going, oh, well, you never could have used action before, so now making it work shouldn't break anybody.
That's sort of the bane of our existence in product dev at Microsoft, is that, you know, as a commercial entity with customers to support, we don't have the luxury that some of the open source projects do of just being able to say, no, we wish we'd have done this thing this way, so that's what we're going to do in the next version. And, you know, they don't have to worry about the backlash so much from breaking, you know, backward compatibility.
True, it's both a pro and a con. I mean, it's a con from us from the standpoint that in some ways we feel that we can't break customers, and so there's parts of the product that we know that are wrong or know that people don't like, but we can't change them because we'll break our customers. But it's also a pro for other customers because it's like, hey, you know, I know that as new versions of the framework come out, I'm going to have a really high compatibility bar between versions of the framework, and I don't have to worry about going and, you know, fixing my application. You know,
right.
A great example of this is the exact same case of .NET 3.5.SP1. Imagine you have a website, and you've gone to hoster of your choice, and you've published your website on hoster of your choice. And the next version of our framework comes out, they install it, and suddenly you have all the benefits of the new version of the framework. But at the same time, you didn't have to recompile your application. You didn't have to resend your application up to the hoster because your application runs the same way it did before. Imagine if you built a PHP application and on PHP version XYZ, and your hoster upgrades to the next major version of PHP, and your app no longer works.
Well, the other thing that is great about the recent versions of the .NET framework is that they're happy to run side by side. So I actually have hosting accounts where I have 2.0 apps and 3.5 apps running on the same box, the same instance of IIS, and just configured in the web.config file, and it works fine.
Right. That is one of the big benefits that's coming in Visual Studio 2010, is traditionally, if you're a developer, you basically had to keep probably multiple versions of Visual Studio on your machine based on what version of the framework, you know, one of your websites is targeting. So if you have a version of your website that's targeting the 1.1 framework, you would have to have Visual Studio 2003 on your box. You know, if you have something targeting the 2.0 framework, you'd have Visual Studio 2005 or 2008 on your box. One of the features that we're doing in Visual Studio 2010 is having full, what we call multi-targeting support in the tool, which means basically with Visual Studio 2010, you can build a 2.0 application, a 3.0 application, a 3.5 application, or a 4.0 application, all within one tool. And not feel like you have to switch from one version of the tool to another version of the tool. There's lots of, I think, great benefits to the customer from this, which is basically, even if the classic case of this is I'm a consultant, I'm building websites for a company, and because of their internal IT policies, they've not upgraded their internal systems to the latest version of our framework yet. They're still on 2.0 or they're on 3.0.
Right.
They haven't made their way to 4, or they haven't made their way to 3.5. And the tool allows me to say, basically, I can still take advantage of all the new features of the tool and target the old framework. So that's something we have coming in Visual Studio 2010 that I think our customers will really enjoy.
Cool. Hey, I want to back up, and I want to talk about web forms a little bit before we get to developer-customer questions. So we sort of skipped over MVC, and I'm not going to let you off the hook quite as easily as you might have thought. So, you know, there's guys on my team, Stephen Walther, that are really heavily focused on MVC, and I sort of held true and had lots of email from customers asking me to stick to this, that I'm going to stay a web forms guy. MVC is interesting. I hear the number thrown around, maybe 10% of our developers will use MVC. One of the interesting things that I've tracked, although there's a lot of dialogue, a lot of publication on the web, for example, that is MVC related. If you follow it, sometimes it's interesting to see that a lot of the things that MVC guys are complaining about are the things that are missing from MVC that are in web forms. So you see, you know, where's ViewStator? How come I can't use controls? And the question harkens back is, you know, is one really more productive than the other in a general sense?
I think that's a tough question. I think, you know, today what I would look at is I look at the two technologies as kind of control. So what I mean by that is one technology gives you more control than the other technology. So today, web forms allows very rapid development because it has a very rich control hierarchy or it's control based. And these controls can encapsulate a lot of information. So, for example, you know, I could build a web form application very quickly by dragging a SQL reporting services charting tool to my page, and suddenly I'm showing charts from SQL Server. You know, I can go to various third party control vendors. They're going to have rich HTML editors. They're going to have tree controls. They're going to have grids that do all kinds of crazy stuff that almost make the web feel like a desktop application. But, you know, in all those cases that I just wrote off, I mean, you know, those controls are doing a lot for you. They're abstracting away a lot of stuff, and that's a pro from the standpoint that gives you very rapid development. It's con from the standpoint that, you know, if I go drag the SQL reporting services control on my page, I don't know what it's going to render. And, you know, if I need full control of what's being rendered, I'm not going to have that.
So let's explore a couple of those features, and I'll ask you about discussions that you have in the feature teams about, you know, what sorts of things might get added to web forms in the future. So, I mean, one of the things is, with MVC, you're basically responsible entirely for the markup that's rendered by your application. And folks like the control model. One of the questions that a developer sent me was asking about, were there plans to improve the control creation process for web forms, and specifically to be able to make the ASCX controls compilable into an assembly, and also questions about, Would the designer experience improve for creating user controls?
I would just ask the question back. When they say the designer experience would improve for creating user control, I'd be curious what they ask for that.
Well, so the general feeling is that writing the code that emits HTML in a user control is a little cumbersome, and you have to in most cases you have to write design time rendering code separate from runtime rendering code. I don't think they were looking for a specific answer. I think they were just, you know, more or less looking for, you know, for what's the future of the control development experience moving forward, since that's one of the strong features of web forms, but the detail of implementation might be an inhibitor to some folks. And one of the ways that might be solved is to create a mechanism by which you convert ASCXs into assemblies.
Yeah, well, for your first question, which is basically, is there going to be some way to take an ASCX file and convert it into assembly? That's an interesting one that I've seen before. There are ways to do it today that aren't necessarily the cleanest ways. One of the people that's on the data team here is David Ebbo, and I will make sure that I provide Joe with David Ebbo's blog URL after this, and he can actually reference it in the podcast. David Ebbo, who actually probably created a lot of this stuff, he was one of the very early members of the team that built a lot of the low-level stuff that makes up ASP.NET. He actually has a blog post on how to actually convert an ASCX control into a assembly today. It's not the cleanest process, and I would love to hear feedback from this podcast if people think that's something that they run across on a regular basis. And we would definitely investigate that as a future area of investment in web forms. And that does make sense to me. I could see that, there's two ways of writing controls. If you're going to write a control in web forms today, and that is, you can do the bare metal approach, which is basically I derive it from the control, and I override the render method and basically emit the HTML by hand to build the actual control. And that's how, a lot of our internal controls are built. And then there's the other way of building controls, which is what Joe mentioned, which is ACX files, ASCX files. And this is actually where you get a form that looks very similar to a regular page, and you can actually drag other controls and stuff from your toolbox into this control, and they'll render. And so this is, this is a way that a lot of our customers probably build their controls when they're building an application. They might take common pieces of element of UI that's in a page and add that to an ASCX file, and then add that ASCX file to multiple pages in their application.
Right, but sometimes the objection, though, is that as an ASCX file, that file, meaning that source code, actually has to be in a project. It's not backable. It's not distributable.
Yeah, that's the path I was just going to go down. And that's something that we haven't invested in .NET 4, but I would love to hear feedback from this podcast. I'd love for you to, hopefully this is going to be published in a way that people can actually comment on it. And we would like to know if this is an area that people are really interested in, is having some mechanism where we can take the ASCX files and then easily distribute them in a binary/assembly format. If this is something that our customers would like us to invest in.
Well, the other thing I'll do is I'll sync up with David and look into maybe doing a How Do I podcast on using his technique to create an assembly from an ASCX file.
So, yeah, I recommend that too. But this technique, is kind of cumbersome and probably has a couple limitations. But it will get somebody that's really trying to do this, it will get them in a position where they could actually do it.
Well, if nothing else, it would be a great catalyst for feedback in terms of whether this is a feature that we should invest in or not.
That's why I'm asking the question is, you do have a very valid point. Building a raw low-level control, it's very easy to put that in an assembly and distribute that. The ASCX way of building controls, which, as I said, I think most of our customers, that's probably what they do. I think control vendors probably write all their controls using overwriting the render method and emitting all the HTML. While most of our customers build what we would call a composite control, and that's where you actually create an ASCX and drag other controls into it.
Right.
And if that's important for our customers to, if they think it's important, I'd love to hear the feedback.
So another thing that that is receiving good reviews from the folks that are using MVC is that the MVC infrastructure has a great number of extensibility points. And another customer developer asks if we're considering expanding the expansibility points in web forms. I'm just offering that up for you to comment. I think one of the liabilities in web forms is that folks tend to use them in a drag and drop fashion, and they don't really realize lots of them how inheritable and extensible they are as they sit today.
Yeah, I was just going to say I think actually web forms is very, very extensible, and that's I think shown over time by the kinds of things that we've been able to do. I mean, for example, you know, when we started doing our AJAX work and added the update panel to ASP.NET, you know, that shows how extensible ASP.NET is, because you know, we basically could take any control that somebody had already written, and you could drag it in this update panel, and suddenly it got AJAX behaviors. And that meant that, you know, the update panel had to be able to do all kinds of magic, like take the output from the controls it contained and do them in a partial rendering. To me, that just shows there's tons of extensibility already in web forms. In fact, you could actually argue, and we hear this sometimes, that web forms is actually so extensible that it's complicated. I'm sure our customers have heard of what we call the page lifecycle, and this is a series of events that occur when a page is being built. And these are all hooks at various parts of the page being built that you can hook in and do actions. And while it's very extensible, I would also say that that's also something that's complicated for people who's trying to understand what should occur in each of these events. What are you allowed to do? When should I do work? Should I do it in page init? Should I do it in pre-render? Should I do it in render? So I do think web forms actually is very, very extensible, and that is displayed by the types of controls that, you know, the third parties have built, and the ability for us to AJAXify things, and not even have the developer even have to worry about it. I mean, you know, as I said, I think the great example is the update panel. You know, this control comes out, and suddenly, without having any AJAX knowledge at all, you can basically place controls in this thing, and you get a nice seamless screen refresh.
And, you know, and I think that we have to take some of the responsibility for that perceived complexity on the, you know, on the dev community and dev education side of the house. That I recently did a how do I video on the page lifecycle, and I got tons of email about, you know, great, I never understood that this was a sequence of events, and for each event in the page lifecycle, I tried to provide examples of, you know, here's the kind of thing you might do at this stage in the page lifecycle and why you would do it here instead of someplace else. And I had tons of feedback about, this is great, I've always wondered, you know, what you would do there, or I've never seen sort of a chronological explanation. And I think that the more folks need to dig into the plumbing, the more, you know, maybe we need to provide guidance that explains that. And I don't think most of these things necessarily are complex. It's that trying to figure them out without knowing where to start is where the perception of complexity comes in.
Yeah, I think that's one of the, you know, the pros and cons of web forms. One of the pros of web forms is, you know, I can drag and drop things onto a page, and then I start trying to do something a little bit more complicated and it doesn't work, and I start scratching my head going, why doesn't it work? And it's because of what you just basically said. It's the you know, order of events and things happen, and you can only do certain things in certain parts of the cycle. And that unfortunately, that is one of the things, and that's one of the negative feedbacks on web forms as well. It's one of the pros from the standpoint that you are able to do the drag and drop. It's one of the cons in that, you know, the drag and drop went very, very fast, and you got exactly what you wanted. And then as you start trying to customize it, because you don't know or understand the full cycle and what order, the order of things happen and when you're allowed to do things, you know, you might run into some walls as you try to do that. Unfortunately, that's one of the things where the MVC crowd, people that are using MVC, might initially feel that MVC is simpler or easier because it doesn't have the same cycle of events.
I think that's a complete spoof. As somebody who's had to write a lot of HTML and JavaScript and server-side handling from scratch, you know, I think that's a spoof. Yeah, it's easy to look at a bit of HTML or a bit of JavaScript and say, oh, that's easier, it's simple to understand, I have complete control. But when you need to write really rich user interfaces and then do rich server-side processing of the data that's submitted and organized workflow, you know, I think, you know, writing in HTML and JavaScript is every bit as complex as figuring out how to work with the, you know, the underworkings of web forms.
I agree with you. I think that's where it's, you know, and I don't know where this is going to go with in the podcast, but I think that's an interesting distinction. I mean, one of the things that, you know, you'll hear very common when we talk about MVC is MVC gives you full control. And so what MVC is expecting is MVC is expecting you to understand HTML. It's expecting you to understand how when you press the submit button on a page, what the browser does, what data does it send back to the page it's being requested to. It's expecting, and that's where MVC and web forms are very different, is MVC is expecting you to have all this knowledge about how HTML works, how HTTP works, how your browser works. You need to have that information because it's giving you that bare metal control and not doing a lot of the abstraction for you. You have to understand that stuff.
Right.
And so, you know, as you come in as an MVC developer, you better know HTTP. You better know HTML. You better know how your browser works, and how web pages work in general.
Right.
And so that's why I think that, you know, it targets one audience. MVC targets definitely that would be the target audience. Hey, I already know how HTML works. I know how all these things work, and I want full control. And that's where MVC kind of appeals to that particular audience. While web forms doesn't require you to understand. You know, you still have to understand some of the concepts, but not nearly as much. You don't have to worry about a lot of those things. That's one of the benefits of web forms is I don't have to understand how all those things work exactly, because web forms are giving me a very nice abstraction on top of all that hides a lot of the complexity from that.
Right, and maybe one other one other place where MVC might have an advantage is if I have a relatively significant PHP application or Ruby on Rails application, I can migrate all that HTML and JavaScript code directly without having to reef back it up to use web forms.
Exactly, and that's I think that's a great point, Joe. That's because just as we said, those technologies don't abstract away or try to make easier a lot of the HTML type stuff. So they obviously have a much more one-to-one mapping to MVC than they would their web forms, because, you know, as you go to web forms, stuff just, you know, automatically happens for you. If I put three controls on a page, you know, first name, last name, social security number or ID, the user types in those things and presses the save button, you know, I just go access those controls and they give me the value of that. You know, in the case of a PHP application, or a Rails application, or even an MVC application, you know, what's going to happen is those input elements are going to exist on the page, and it's going to be up to the developer to go and know that when the browser posts that page back, or posts to a different page, that in the form element, in the request object that comes back, there'll be a whole dictionary of values, and you need to go manually go look at those dictionary of values to go pull those things out.
Right.
So once again, if you know how the web works, that might feel very very comfortable to you.
Right.
But you know, the web forms, you know, kind of hides all that and makes it very simple. It's like, hey, there's this text box on the page. If I want to go find the value of that text box, I just go ask the text box, what is your value? If I want to put a value in that text box, I take a value and add it and set the value on the text box. You know, that's a very natural, especially, you know, as we mentioned earlier in the podcast, you know, it's very natural for somebody coming from Visual Basic or you know, any kind of Windows development to have that kind of natural feel. I don't think one way is necessarily worse or better than the other. I mean, it's that's why, you know, you'll hear us at trade shows and stuff say, these technologies are not meant to replace one another. These technologies are both going to coexist, and we're going to invest in both of them, and they provide different benefits. I mean, you know, if you're a bare metal HTML guy and want that full control, then MVC is good for you. You know, you're just trying to get a web application thrown together quickly with a lot of functionality, then web forms, you know, might be better for you.
Well, I love Phil Hack and his work and the other guys that are working on MVC, but I'm a WebForms guy, and I'm going to stay a WebForms guy.
Well, I'm going to laugh. I'll throw out something. Phil Hack also worked on the WebForms menu control.
Right.
that's coming out in 4. So in .NET 4, as part of the CSS work that we're doing, our menu control that we have has been notorious for generating some ugly markup.
Well, and I also just like to give Phil a hard time, and so every time I see him, I pick on him and say the whole MVC thing is just to make the alt.NET guys happy.
Well, I want to give him a hard time as well and say basically, all you MVC folks out there, Phil also worked in WebForm. So he was the program manager for the all the new rendering, CSS compatible rendering for the menu control in 4, and so. He doesn't just live in the MVC world.
Very cool. So, hey, we're going to get to the speed round. So I have a list of questions that I've sort of compiled and homogenized from the development community relative to web forms, and I'm going to fire them at you. Quick questions, short answers. The first one is, will I ever be able to include more than one form with its own target action in an ASP.NET page?
Answer would be, I'm not sure. So we actually had an MVP summit recently. This is a thing where we actually have a bunch of our MVPs that answer questions on the forums and stuff come in, and we got that exact same question, and we're going to investigate it.
Okay. Standard ASP.NET controls. When will they all have AJAX functionality? When will the AJAX control toolkit controls be baked into so that they appear alongside all of the standard ASP.NET controls? And can they just have a property that says use AJAX or don't use AJAX?
The quick answer to that is the AJAX control that is within the AJAX control toolkit will stay in the AJAX control toolkit, and we're doing that on purpose because as something is moved into the framework, as soon as something's in the framework, it has all the compatibility issues that we brought up earlier in this podcast.
Right.
And so, because the web is changing really quickly, we would like to leave the AJAX control in the AJAX control toolkit so we can rev them outside of the framework. We just revved that a week ago, and you're going to see the AJAX control toolkit being refreshed a lot more frequently, starting as of the refresh we just did 2 weeks ago.
How about a management plugin in Visual Studio to say, install the AJAX control toolkit, this version, pop up and tell me when there's a new release, that sort of thing, rather than developers having to keep their own website or read our blogs and go manually do the install of updates.
So we originally in Visual Studio 2010, we were actually going to install the AJAX control toolkit by default. We ran out of time to finish that work, so it will not be in the box in Visual Studio 2010. But Visual Studio 2010 actually has a new feature called the gallery. And the gallery is something that can go and do exactly what you said. Go
awesome.
Look at a bunch of stuff that lives on the web and notify you when that stuff is updated.
And I assume that will work for the related question of the Silverlight control tools.
Silverlight control tool.
The Silverlight control toolkit. So there's an associated question that says, I want to work with Silverlight controls in the same easy way that I work with the standard ASP.NET controls. But it sounds like the gallery can be configured for Silverlight controls as well, right? I mean,
it can be configured for any kind of content. So it could be ASP.NET controls. It could be Silverlight controls. It could be WinForm controls, whatnot. And it'll be up to the user to go configure the gallery to point to the content that they want. But I should also say that it's too early for me to talk about, but we are looking at having some kind of maybe ASP.NET install that installs, newer versions of our stuff between frameworks.
Cool.
And the AJAX control toolkit could be part of that.
Great. Next question. Mobile web forms. Now you see them, now you don't.
Yeah, so mobile web forms is something that we would actually like to remove from the framework, and I'll explain. We don't think that mobile web forms were created. That was when WAP was a which is a very limited web experience, was the common experience that you saw on a mobile phone. And as the iPhones have come out, the Google Android phones, and the newer Windows mobile phones, with Windows Mobile 6.5 and stuff, the browsers in mobile phones, you know, are coming up to par with the browsers on our desktops. And because of that, we would actually, we think moving forward, the way to build websites for phones is using the exact same rich control that you would build a ASP.NET website today with. We are actually going to work on some guidance on how you would build a mobile phone application both in MVC and in web forms, with the main target of that being really what you want to do is you want to say, here's my website. If I detect it's a phone, I want to go to a directory on my website that has a slightly different rendering that fits that phone screen.
You preempted my obvious next question, exactly that.
But it would be using the exact same rich controls that we already have because the newer phones have come up in compatibility, you know, with capabilities to the same power of a desktop browser.
And the resolutions on those phones are increasing, you know, every six-month cycle.
Everything is increasing. So I think the big thing today is really, and you can see this today, if you go to like, you know, if you go to Hotmail on an iPhone, you'll get a very rich interface that now fits the screen of the iPhone. And so we think that our web form developers and our MVC developers both, that's really more of what they want to do is basically be able to detect a device and say, hey, I know that a Windows mobile device has a screen this big. I know that an iPhone has a screen that's this big. I know that a Google Android phone has a screen that's this big. And I'm going to detect what the person's using when they hit my website and take them to a rendering of that size. But those pages will be built with our existing control.
Right. Awesome. So the next question is that Microsoft is developing lots of services and other things outside, perhaps, of DevDiv proper. And is the ASP.NET team ever going to create a set of controls that make accessing that technology easy? So things like Messenger chat control, a virtual Earth control, a live search control, that sort of thing.
Yeah, this is definitely an area that we're looking at. A great example of this that I like to point out is something we look at very, very heavily is like Google App Engine. And I mentioned Google App Engine mainly from the standpoint that if you look at the APIs that are exposed to Google App Engine, they expose the calendaring aspects of Google Calendar. They expose the email aspects of Google Mail. And we would definitely like to do a lot of partner type shifts with, especially the live team and be able to say that we actually provide you APIs that make it easy to access a live calendar, live email, live photo, and give you some of those same types of capabilities, you know, against our competes in those particular areas.
Right. So another question has to do with administration. So we now have in ASP.NET this collection of login controls that work with the ASP.NET membership system. We also have this cool website configuration utility that we can run from inside Visual Studio. And the question is, why can't I deploy part of that to my production website? Why do I have to take the controls and build all of that admin from scratch? Is there any plans to either create a version of that management utility or some new thing that I can deploy along with my web application to let folks sign up for new membership, to manage users, et cetera?
Couple ways to answer that is we don't currently have any plans to build a membership editor that could easily be deployed on a website. We are addressing some of this stuff in some ways from the standpoint we do have new when you build a default project in .NET 4, you will get membership and all this stuff built into your application by default, along with the page for creating users and stuff like that. So we are taking a lot of these concepts and building them into default templates just as guidance for our customers. I don't know if we'll actually take that that configuration editor and actually make it something that you could actually deploy to your website. I'm not even aware if any third parties have done that yet.
No, but it sounds like a great CodePlex project.
It does sound like a great CodePlex project. I think it's actually too open because there's too many knobs that can be turned there that we would actually productize something like that. But it does sound like an interesting project for even, you know, I'm not opposed to even having our team build something like that and just putting it on CodePlex. Here is something, it's not 100% perfect. Start with it and tailor it to your needs.
So I've actually started playing with that idea, and there's a bunch of stuff that would need to not go, right? So there are things like you wouldn't want anybody at runtime to be able to change the authentication mode of your application. So there are features like that that wouldn't be in the, you know, in the one that you would deploy with your website.
I think the main point you're talking about though is some kind of tool that allows me to
add users to roles,
add, edit, delete users, add, edit, delete roles, and maybe when I'm actually looking at a user, be able to go and see whatever fields have been configured for their profile,
right,
and edit those as well.
Right.
And that's what makes something like this very tricky is, you know, part of these sets of controls we're talking about, you know, we actually allow you to have very rich profiles where in your configuration you can basically say, here's the field, here's the data type that they have, and somehow this tool would have to kind of loop through that and, you know, automatically cook up some UI for that.
Right. Has there ever been any talk about adding print functionality, either print to printer or print to PDF functionality for controls or web forms?
You know, that has not come up since I've been on the team. But I do know a lot of third-party controls do support this kind of stuff. So I have used some third-party controls that actually allow me to take things and, you know, export to Excel or export to Word or export to PDF. Even the SQL reporting services stuff actually allows you to print both as PDF. Actually, that's what they do. They actually print the PDF.
Right.
They export PDF and print the PDF.
But that's a great point for folks that are listening, though, is that, you know, you've never heard of that feature. Some folks have emailed me about that feature. And that's what I want to happen with this podcast. So, you know, if you're hearing this guy who, you know, drives a lot of the feature decisions around what happens in the next 2-3 versions of various ASP.NET features like web forms, say, I've never, you know, in all of the years I've been on this team, I've never heard that as a request. You know, that's when you want to, you know, go to the contact tab on misfitgeek.com and, you know, send an email so that I can communicate, you know, those numbers back to the product team.
Yeah, and I would add back on the print case. If we did add some kind of print, I mean, to me, when I just start thinking about that off the top of my head, I start thinking of, okay, if I just want to print a web page, well, that functionality is pretty much already there. The browser supports, you know, and has a print button. One thing we could do is we could actually have, once again, it's probably something we do on CodePlex. We could basically give you a print button, and all the print button would do is actually fire the right JavaScript off to actually have the browser ask you to print the page. That'd be one way of doing that. The other way of doing that, which as I said, is some of the third-party controls that are out there have done is, you know, if you are showing a grid or you're showing some kind of schedule control or something,
right,
then that control itself might wish to have the ability to print or convert a PDF. And so I would ask the users that are listening, you know, if print is something that's interesting for you, you would have to give us more context. I mean, is it printing a grid view? Because, you know, I don't think printing a web page itself is that interesting. The question is it typically, I think, the print, you'd want print on a richer abstraction, be it a grid view or that might be showing, you know, spreadsheet type data.
Or even a particular content area. So, for example, the Ajax Control Toolkit version that just released has an editor control, and there's a preview mode in that editor control. Folks might want to not just print out the entire web page, but print out just the rich text content that appears in that particular section.
Sure.
So can you talk to me about WebParts? WebParts was this really interesting idea that got a lot of play, continues to be used very actively in the SharePoint world, which seems for some reason to be, the SharePoint community seems to be somewhat separated from the ASP.NET community proper. Is there a core strategy around web parts? Is there a feature for web parts for the average ASP.NET developer, or is that more or less going to be a SharePoint specific thing?
We think at this point that it's going to be a SharePoint-specific thing. They're obviously the biggest consumer of web parts today. And for the people that are listening that aren't really aware of what web parts are, web parts are some low-level tools for building portal-type applications. You know, basically, you can put controls on a page and say this control can contain other controls and provide, you know, context menus and stuff for letting the end user add or remove content from these containers. At this point, we don't get a lot of customer requests around the web part area. As I said, our biggest customer is obviously SharePoint, which is a very successful customer, and they use web parts very heavily in SharePoint. But we don't currently have any plans to invest any more in web parts right now because we're not hearing a lot of customer feedback around web parts. It would be interesting if you get feedback, Joe. One of the guys on the team, Mike Harder, is kind of the creator and owner of web parts, and we could easily have him, you know, come on a podcast and talk specifically about that feature.
Great. So in the minutes that we have left, and I definitely want to do podcast coverage about some of the new stuff that's in 4.0, but in the minutes that we have left, would you like to give us sort of a whirlwind, you know, here are some of the things that I think are the coolest in ASP.NET 4.0?
So all I'm going to talk about right now is I'll talk about, we just released Beta 1 of Visual Studio 2010.NET 4 actually today. So Wednesday is the day that release is going out to the general public. It was released to our MSDN customers on Monday. For Beta 1 related stuff, I'd recommend we have a white paper that we added on the web. It's at www.asp.net/learn/whitepapers. If you go to that link, you'll see that there's a document up there with all the ASP.NET changes that are in Beta 1. And I would like to go through a couple of these just quickly. There's more content there. I'm actually looking at the document. It's 47 pages. So there's 47 pages of detailed descriptions of the changes that we have coming in .NET 4. And this is just for Beta 1. Beta 2 has got a whole other slew of features that are coming as well.
So that's a great point before you continue with some of those resources is for folks to realize that if they go down and download the version that was released to the general public today, that's not a feature complete version. So, you know, more features will be added as we get closer to final release. So don't, you know, people shouldn't look at it and go, oh, that's everything that's going to be in the new version. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, so our plan is, and just, you know, I can actually share this, I think, is we're just now at the process of checking in the second round of changes that we made for .NET 4. That happened just recently. But for the stuff that's up there right now, we have a white paper. We'll actually update that white paper, I hope, you know, within the next 30 to 60 days, we'll update that white paper and add all the stuff that's coming in the next round of changes. But some of the big ones that I think especially are important for the customer that we talked about today is web forms. We've done some stuff to help people to try to do SEO. SEO is for search engine optimization. We actually added page.meta keywords and page.meta description, which are just two easily settable properties to set some of the simply set some of the very common ways that you would set SEO information in your page. One of the things that we always hear complaints about, again, from our web form customers is we have this feature called View State, which is awesome, but our default controls used it just had too much of it turned on by default, and we've actually added a bunch of new capabilities. Which we call granular view state, which allow you much finer control of when view state is used. One of the features that people heard when they see anything about MVC is routing. And routing is the ability to have the actual URL that the end user sees in their browser be different than the actual structure of your pages and your website. And it's an important feature from the standpoint of sometimes when I build my website in my tool, I want to name things and put things in a specific, you know, way based on how I'm developing it. but I might want to use much friendlier names and friendlier URLs for the end user. So instead of saying, a great example of this is you might have a thing that says products / categories, dollar sign category ID equals 5. That's not very, intuitive, number one, for the end user. And as the search engines like Google and Live come over and index your site, Google's not going to have any idea what category ID equals 5 means. It's much cooler to have your web page actually say product/category/television.
Right.
And routing is a feature that allows you to do that kind of manipulation while keeping your pages the exact same as they are today. And we actually add full routing capabilities to web forms in .NET 4. Another cool feature is the ability to control client IDs. This is something that we talked heavily about early in the podcast today. A pain point that web form developers have had for a long time, and we've addressed this in .NET 4, giving you a lot more control over client IDs. This is something that's been a pain point for web form developers for, a long time, and very happy to address that in .NET 4. I think it'll make a lot of our customers happy. I'm going to touch on something that we just started to work on in beta 1. The rest of it's going to follow in a later release, and that is, we talked a little bit about this earlier in the podcast as well, which is much better CSS support for ASP.NET developers. And so some of the small work that you see in beta 1 is some of our control, just because they have to have some element to actually put attributes on. Even if you take a templated control like a form view, a templated control is a control where you can actually put a template in there that controls exactly what the markup's going to look like. We wrap your template in a table without asking you. And so you're going to see that we actually have some options where you can take that outside wrap table off of the control. And you're going to see a lot more of that moving forward in a future release when we've done that for all of the controls and stuff, part of our CSS work.
And when we start getting towards feature completeness on stuff like that, one of the things that I would love to do is enumerate them in a way that customers can sort of vote on which ones are the most exciting to them, and then sit down with your team and come up with a content plan so that we have a lot of good guidance around all of those new features before we ship.
Yeah, actually, in the case of the CSS, we're actually working on a white paper, which is basically how to, and this will happen before we release, we'll actually have a white paper on how to build an XHTML strict, CSS-compatible web form website that will have guidance on how to do all the right things to use these features. So I know we're doing that for the CSS feature, and we will have this white paper that I'm pointing everybody to today will also be updated, but I would love to do more of this with you as well. So, something else we have a really cool, what we call query tender control. A lot of customer feedback we have in the data control space has been, data controls are great, but I really want to do rich filtering. One of the most common filterings that we find that people want to do is, I just want to add a box somewhere on the page where somebody can search inside of a data control. And the query extender is something we've added that tries to address this particular need. When we worked on the dynamic data feature in 3.5 SP1 and we shipped it, a lot of the feedback we got was, how do I add more filtering? And kind of a response to this, which ends up helping all of web forms, is the query extender. And it basically allows you to have a rich, you can do a search, which is a string search. It supports ranges where you can actually say, show me all the values that match a certain range. It supports a bunch of other stuff as well, but that's all done in a very cool, simple to use fashion where the user doesn't have to worry about trying to figure out what SQL needs to be generated to do that or how to build some complex where clause. Basically, you just say, hey, I want to search these columns for this text. I think really cool control, and I think our customers are really going to get a kick out of it.
You know what I'm loving about the whole list that you've just gone through is that, I joined Microsoft about 8 years ago, so it was before we started shipping the very first version of .NET. And it's you know, it's sometimes it's difficult to be Microsoft. We're a very visible target, and the press likes to sort of ding at us all the time. But it's great to sort of, you know, to listen to this great list of cool new features, and they're all stuff that customers have told us. This is what we need to make the product better. So it's not, you know, it's not all about what's the new cool thing that we want to do. All of this is about stuff that customers have asked us for.
That's correct. As I said, we consider our team to be very customer driven. So we go look at our customer pain points, and a lot of the work you're going to see in .NET 4 is trying to address those things. That's probably all the stuff that I'm going to say for web forms in beta 1. But I do want to point out a couple other feature areas. We do have a bunch of new AJAX functionality that we've done in 4.0. A lot of it is around a common complaint that we might hear is, you know, we have these rich abstractions for doing server-side data, where I have a grid view and I can build some nice templates and show data. We also hear the same thing from people that are trying to do AJAX sites. And this is, I want to build an AJAX site that does this all from the client. So instead of writing server-side code, you would be writing JavaScript code. But, you know, a lot of our developers and a lot of developers don't have the time to go figure out all the ins and outs of various flavors of JavaScript, how it reacts to all the different browsers and such. And so we've actually got some really cool AJAX functionality that's in the beta, which is around having some of the same abstractions we have on the server on the client. So you actually have the idea of notion of a data source, the notion of a repeater, and a binding syntax, which allows you basically, you can basically write fully declaratively a control that will, or some markup that will actually show a grid of data on the client side without writing any JavaScript.
And it's great that we're innovating not just on the server side where, you know, our products live, but on the client side as well.
Yeah, so I mean that's one of the things that we've heard from our customers as well is server side's great, but I also want to do client side as well. And something else that you might laugh is we've also heard that you know, we need to make sure we do a balance that some people do like JavaScript. And we want to make sure we address those customers as well. So we're not trying to also just address the server-side customer that doesn't ever do JavaScript. We want to, number one, make the client-side available to a non-JavaScript developer using rich declarative type syntax, very similar to our server-side stuff. But we also want to make, if you are comfortable with JavaScript, we want to make sure that stuff is very accessible to you as a JavaScript developer as well. So, you know, we see both sides.
Well, and you know, I do a lot of presentations. I speak at a lot of conferences for web developers, and I tell web developers that there are two kinds of web developers. There are those that love programming in JavaScript, and there are the others that are using it anyway.
Exactly. We it's very common for us at a trade show to ask to raise a hand, you know, who loves it and who hates it, and you get half and half, and we want to make sure we address both of those audiences.
But in either event, it's inevitable.
Yes, it is inevitable. I want to I'll point out a couple other areas. Is Visual Studio itself has gotten a lot of improvements as well. So it's much better at rendering a page in the designer that looks how it would look in the browser. So they've done a lot of work on trying to improve making that look closer. A feature that I think people just pass over on Visual Studio, and I'm going to see there's a video that Jeff King from the Web Tools team did at PDC last year, which is on these snippets, and basically built a web page once without snippets, once with snippets, and timed himself and timed the number of keystrokes, and incredible. I think we should find that show and add a link to that to the podcast. But there's a lot of work done there. And then for people that love the JavaScript side, we've done a lot of work to make in Visual Studio to make the IntelliSense that we do for JavaScript as good as the IntelliSense we do, you know, for the C# or Visual Basic developer. And so a lot of improvements have been done there. A cool feature that I think also coming from the Visual Studio side that customers have been asking for a long time, and I think they're going to really love is we have something called deployment. And what this is a way to easily deploy a website from Visual Studio up into, you know, a hoster or up into your own IIS servers or not. And so what this basically does is it gives you a couple things. It gives you a small language to take your web config file and tweak it for your local development and for the one you publish, because typically you're going to have different connection strings and stuff like that, and some settings in your web config for your production environment, you might have in your debug environment. So you can easily have a debug web config and a release web config. It has a mechanism for actually deploying databases. What actually happens is you're going to push a button. It's going to take your website, zip it up so it's very small, ship the whole thing up in one request to the server, unpack it on the server, and it's going to run. I think it's going to be a cool feature that makes it much easier to deploy websites. And then one final area that we'll talk about is we had this feature called dynamic data that we did in .NET 3.5 SP1.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all about quickly building data-driven websites. We have a lot of improvements to dynamic data.
Who's the tech lead on dynamic data?
What?
Who is the tech lead on dynamic data? Who's driving it?
I'm the program manager on dynamic data, and David Ebo is the architect. We mentioned David earlier in this podcast. He's the architect on dynamic data. One of the really cool things that we have a preview for dynamic data up on our www.codeplex ASP.NET site. And dynamic data, for those that haven't seen it, is a technology for quickly building data-driven websites. It does a lot of the grunt work for you without writing a lot of code. And one of the complaints that you could have about dynamic data 1.0 that we released was it was great if you were building a new website, because it's kind of a starting place. But if you actually have an existing website, how do you integrate dynamic data into your existing website?
Right.
And the preview 4 that we have up on www.codeplex.ASP.NET actually adds new support where you basically can say enable dynamic data on any existing grid view, form view, details view, or list view, and get a bunch of the dynamic data functionality in an existing website. So it'll give you all of our validation, it'll give you our field template mechanisms. So we're really trying to take a lot of the functionality that we created for that feature and make it available to a wider audience. And so that's something we have going on. And then we have various things that we're doing in what we call core. And core is all the low-level parts of ASP.NET that make, you know, everything work. And so examples of things we're doing in core is we have something that's in beta 1 called Auto Start Web Applications. And for people that know how ASP.NET works, is what happens is when you have an app running on a web server, until it's hit the first time, it's actually kind of dormant and not running. And so what will happen is you have a big application, the first time it's hit, it might actually, you know, take a few seconds to spin up, and that gives a bad experience to the customer. And so we actually now have the ability to configure the application to be auto-started. So as soon as it's actually copied up to the web server, it's running all the time, which means when the first hit happens, it'll be very quick. We have session state, and two of the session state providers that we have is the ability to have session state stored in memory or in a SQL database. And we've done a lot of work to actually shrink and compress the amount of space that we use when we use the out-of-proc session state providers. We added some functionality. Once again, this is just a common thing and something our users might get wrong some of the times because you don't think about it, which is if you do a response redirect in ASP.NET, if it's permanent, which means that you put this response redirect on a page that people should never go to anymore because you move the content, we now actually have a way of easily specifying it's a permanent redirect. This is something you'll see if you read SEO documents on how to improve your search engine optimization, and that's built in. Something else that we're doing is something we call extensible output caching, which is allowing ways to plug in and replace the way that we do caching in ASP.NET, and more of that will come in the next release as well, where you can take things like velocity, which is a tool for, you know, if you're building a huge web farm of sites and want all your caching to be done in memory on some other server, we're going to let you actually be able to replace the, you know, ASP.NET caching mechanism with a third-party one like that. So that's just a quick dry run of some of the changes that are in Beta 1. If you go up to that website that we mentioned earlier, there's a full white paper up there with about 50 pages of in-depth examples showing what these things do, how you would use them, and how they would impact your application. And I really would like everybody to go up there and look at that. If you're actually going to grab the beta of Visual Studio 2010, please grab this document and go look at it, and it'll really point out to you the changes we're making. And as I said, we do have a lot more coming, and I don't know when that's going to be released, but there's a lot more coming.
But will everyone get to see it at PDC?
I can't say anything about dates, we will get that when the next round of changes are complete. We will have a milestone where we get those to our customers.
Well, Scott Hunter, thanks very much for all your time today and being my very first guest on my very first podcast. I wanted to do it on web forms because it's so near and dear to my heart.
Thank you very much. And, you know, as I said multiple times on the podcast, love to get your feedback. So please send Joe all the feedback you have. You know, if you have specific questions around Ajax or web forms or MVC, core services, dynamic data, Visual Studio, please ship all that to Joe, and we would love to get back and do another one of these things and actually have various members of each of those teams come and answer those questions.
So I can promise we'll do that, and folks, for forwarding those questions to Scott and the various members of his team, misfitgeek.com/contact. Scott, thanks very much.
Thanks, Joe.